This church year, the church year began last July. This church year, we are studying Karen Armstrong's book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. I chose this title for us last spring, compassion being a central teaching of all the world's major religions. One of our seven Unitarian Universalist principles is justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. Just a year ago, this topic seemed interesting, worthy of study and attention, but not, I don't think, urgent, not paramount. But the November presidential election has revealed to us, for those of us who didn't know it before, revealed to us how divided our country is and how polarized many of us are around politics. There are pronounced divisions between people who voted for Donald Trump, for Hillary Clinton, and for Bernie Sanders. Friendships have ended, and families have become estranged over who you voted for in the last election. The Charter for Compassion defines compassion as that attitude which compels us to work tirelessly to alleviate the suffering of our fellow creatures, to dethrone ourselves from the center of our world and to put another there, and to honor the inviolable sanctity of every single human being, treating everybody without exception with absolute justice, equity, and respect. So can you do that? Can you think of someone who voted differently from you in this last election and treat them with absolute justice, equity, and respect? Some of you, yes. Some of us are working on it. We're on 12 steps to compassionate life. The step from January, step 7, was to acknowledge all that we do not know and cannot know. You were invited to do a very specific series of exercises for that step. The first was to think about experiences we have that move us deeply. Things like listening to a piece of music, reading a powerful poem, spending time with children. Armstrong wanted us to notice how hard it is to speak of them or to say exactly what it is that's moving, hard to put into words. In doing this, we are invited to fully notice our unknowingness. You are also encouraged to listen for aggressive certainty in our culture. That probably wasn't hard to find. You were invited to pick one of your most deeply held opinions about politics, religion, the economy, football, music, movies, business, any deeply held opinion, and make a list of everything you know that supports your viewpoint, and then to make a list of arguments that contradict your viewpoint, to put yourself into a different perspective. I did this exercise on the topic of abortion. I'm pro-choice. I believe women have the right to end a pregnancy if we choose, but I am able to make a pretty good list of arguments in opposition to my own opinion. I could argue that viewpoint. And as the last part of step 7, Armstrong asked you to try and think of traits and qualities that make you uniquely you. What distinguishes you from everybody else? And you were also invited to do the same thing, thinking of someone you love. What makes that person different from everybody else? Traits and qualities. I could do it for experiences, different life experiences, but traits and qualities was harder. So this is part of the work of developing mindfulness, awareness, noticing. It's not that you will be able to identify what distinguishes you or your loved one from everybody else. I wasn't able to do it. But the attempt is an important part of acknowledging all the things we can't know and can't put into words, can't articulate. So that was step 7, acknowledging how little we know. It was a hard step, and the next one's harder. How should we speak to one another? Armstrong invites us to understand the difference between dialogue and debate. When we think about talking with people who disagree with us, we often think, many of us, in terms of debate. Many of us learn debate in high school, right? We learn to win. How will we win the argument? How will we make our points? How will we triumph over the other person and show them how wrong they are? That's not dialogue. That's debate, or what James Hogan in our reading this morning calls a monologue. No real listening occurs when we're debating an opponent, because why listen? We're not here to learn anything new. We're here to triumph over the other person. We're here to compete. We're listening to them for flaws in their argument that we can pounce on to the extent that we're listening. As Armstrong notes, it's not enough for us to seek the truth. We also want to defeat and even humiliate our opponents. The last thing anybody intends is a change of mind. So, what if you entered discussion with the sole intention of understanding the other person, not winning the discussion? I've suggested this before, that we need to learn to listen to each other, to understand each other, and you ask me, but when do I get to make my point? When do I get to say what I think? I'm asking you to consider what it might be like to enter a conversation with someone you disagree with and not make your point. Just let that go. Your sole intention in that conversation would be to understand the other person's viewpoint. And now I imagine you saying to me, as some of you have, but I do understand that person. They're a hateful bigot. Or they're afraid of foreigners, or whatever the reason is. But here's what I need you to know. We will not change people's hearts by ignoring their pain. We will not change people's hearts by refusing to hear their stories. We will not change people's hearts by shunning them. In 2008, Proposition 8 passed in California, eliminating the right of same-sex couples to marry at that time. I was devastated. And then, like now, I realized that nothing would change if people with differing viewpoints never talked about their viewpoints with each other. I had not talked about Prop 8 or gay marriage with any of my conservative family members who I expected were voting for it, and they fully expected that I was voting against it. It seemed like we didn't need to talk about that. It had just seemed volatile, and I wanted to avoid the tension. But when Prop 8 passed, I realized, we have to start talking about these differences. So I phoned one of my closest relatives, someone I love dearly, and someone with whom I disagree on just about every political issue and candidate there is. And I asked her to explain to me why she voted for Prop 8. "Let's not talk about this," she said. It took a few minutes for me to convince her that I really just wanted to understand her point of view. That I didn't want to debate her, I wasn't going to argue, I just wanted to understand. And so we had our conversation, and I asked clarifying questions when I didn't understand what she was telling me. For her, it basically boiled down to the fact that that's how she was raised. It wasn't okay to be gay. It was something you would hide or ignore, and she really just couldn't adjust to the fact that it might be okay. She couldn't overcome her upbringing. This was a telephone call we were having, not a face-to-face meeting, and I'm glad, because unknown to her, I cried through the whole phone call. I sobbed. It was so painful to me to know this person I love so deeply has such a different viewpoint from mine, a viewpoint I think is wrong, frankly, but I understand her better than I did before. It's hard. It hurts. I thanked her for talking to me about her perspective. And that was it. And that's it. There's no big resolution to this story. There's no conversion experience of my relatives. She didn't ask me to explain my viewpoint to her, and we've never spoken about gay marriage again. But as painful as that conversation was, there was also something I think healing and important for our relationship, that I cared enough to ask her to explain her opinion. And that she, in spite of her nervousness about my intentions, took the trouble to explain herself. We care about each other, and that's important. I think it is part of the crisis of our times that we aren't sure anymore as a country that we care about each other. People with differing opinions aren't listening to each other. And what happens when we feel like nobody's listening to us? We talk louder. We lash out. Maybe we start saying things we don't really mean. Because why be careful with your words when nobody's listening anyway? And then what happens when somebody really listens to us? We start to think about what we're saying. We take more care to find the words that express what we really think and feel. We do that work of trying to put hard things into words. When we feel heard, we feel calmer. We're more grounded. And in the best of conversations, we find our ways to new truths we hadn't articulated before. Listening is the foundational skill of conflict resolution, of pastoral care, of nonviolent communication. On this step, Armstrong asks us to try and make ourselves mindful of the way we speak to others. When you argue, do you get carried away by your own cleverness and deliberately inflict pain on your opponent? Do you get personal? What would happen if, while debating a trivial matter that would have no serious consequences, what would happen if you allowed yourself to lose the argument? So this step is not about phoning up the person we have the strongest disagreement with. This isn't leaping into the deep end. It's just about becoming aware of how we act when we're in conversation. I'm going to add to this, she wrote her book in 2010, for those of us on Facebook or other forms of social media to think about the posts you choose to share. Are they stating a position or opinion, or are they mocking, humiliating, and punishing those with different opinions? I will confess to you that I've been giggling this week about something that isn't politically meaningful at all, but was just a humiliating incident for people whose politics are different from mine. I didn't share it on my Facebook page, but I've been sharing it conversationally and laughing. My giggling is innocuous, but it's also not who I aspire to be. I don't want to be someone who laughs at other people. And I don't want what feels like the ugliness around me to drag me down too. I know many of you feel anxious about this question. How will we change other people's minds if we aren't arguing with them? I encourage you to reflect on times that you've changed your mind about an issue and what happened that changed your mind. My opinions have been influenced by discussions with friends and family, by my own reading and research, by my experiences and observations. But the moment of insight and change has always come from my own self-reflection and self-discovery. When someone has wanted to debate me about my opinion, the result has usually been that I get better at articulating my opinion. Not that I change my mind. It is part of the crisis of our times that we aren't sure we care about each other. We aren't listening to each other. Instead, more and more, we're making fun of each other. This is not who we want to be. This is not who we want to be as Unitarian Universalists, and it's not who we want to be as Americans. To invite more compassion into who you are, try and make yourself mindful of the way you speak to others. Try to let go of winning or punishing or competing. Listen. 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 We can change the world with our love. May it be so. Amen and blessed be.